Hello, it's Alyssa Milano, and I can't wait for you to read my new book, Sorry Not Sorry. It's a collection of essays where I share my unapologetic thoughts on life, culture, activism, and motherhood. You'll learn some things about me that I know you've never heard before and share in my story as an activist. This book is such a big part of my heart, and so are you, and thank you for that. Sorry Not Sorry is available now, everywhere books are sold.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hi, I'm Alyssa Milano, and this is Sorry Not Sorry. Our guest this week is Senator Richard Blumenthal of Connecticut. Senator Blumenthal is right at the heart of legislative initiatives that are so important for our nation, whether it's regulating the role of AI, protecting kids online or offline in efforts to reduce gun violence.
This betrayal by the U.S. Supreme Court is where we begin this hour with Senator Richard Blumenthal.
Today, lawmakers advanced a bill aimed at keeping children safe online. Tennessee Senator Marsha Blackburn spearheaded that effort alongside a senator from Connecticut. Both lawmakers say the Kids Online Safety Act protects children on social media and also holds big tech companies accountable.
You signed the statement about the societal risks posed by AI. Can you describe a realistic scenario in which the world or humanity is destroyed by AI?
So it's a little bit like asking the dodos how it was that humans were going to make them extinct.
Gun violence is now the leading cause of death among children and teens across the country, surpassing motor vehicle accidents for the first time ever.
Hi, I'm Richard Blumenthal, United States Senator for Connecticut. Honored to be with you. I am passionate about protecting kids from social media's harms and protecting women's health care and reproductive rights against the onslaught from the right wing.
Senator Blumenthal, welcome to Sorry Not Sorry. Thank you so much for being with us. There's so much I want to talk to you about, but I'd love to just start out by asking you to tell our listeners a little bit about you and the work that you do.
A little bit about me is, first, I am a U.S. senator, have been for the last 13 years, after serving for, believe it or not, five terms, which is 20 years as Connecticut's attorney general. I have been a state official, but I also was a federal prosecutor for 4.5 years. And the majority of my career has been spent in law enforcement, in making sure that people are protected, not only against criminal activities, but also consumer fraud, scams, cons. I sued the big tobacco companies as well as Microsoft. So I believe in using the law to protect people. And that informs a lot of what I've done as a United States Senator as well.
Speaking of scams and cons, I want to start out really by asking you about the recently released ProPublica report that shows just how many lavish gifts the Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas received over decades from several billionaires. Should people in positions of huge public trust, like the members of the Supreme Court, be held to specific ethical standards?
You know, these reports are really mind-boggling. I never, ever would have guessed that a public official, not to mention a justice of the highest court in the land, could commit these kind of severe errors of judgment and misconduct, violation of basic ethical standards. I was a law clerk for Supreme Court Justice Harry Blackmun, and he would not accept a dinner invitation, not to mention a trip on a jet or a private yacht or this other stuff, which is just sickening. It really is revolting. And it is why I believe so strongly that we need the Supreme Court to have a code of ethics. I have helped to lead legislation that would require the Supreme Court to have a code of ethics.
I don't think people understand that there is no code of ethics for the Supreme Court.
That is absolutely right. It really is, again, mind-boggling. The highest court in the land has no, zero code of ethics, when every other court, every other federal judge, every other federal official is subject to a code of ethics. These nine men and women are accountable and answerable to no one when it comes to ethical standards.
And Justice Alito, I know you know this, recently said that Congress has no power to regulate the Supreme Court. Do you agree with him? What does that mean for the future of the Supreme Court?
I'll use a word that I would never use before the Supreme Court, but it's baloney. It's bogus. Because, you know, the Congress regulates the jurisdiction of the court. It regulates the number of justices. In fact, it's changed the number of justices over the years. It regulates the annual spending of the court. The court would have no money to pay its justices or the federal courts to pay their judges without the Congress allocating it. So again, I use this term mind-boggling for a justice to make that kind of statement, for Justice Thomas and Justice Alito to act as though they're answerable to no one.
So what's the next step to hold them accountable?
The Senate Judiciary Committee approved a code of ethics bill. It now goes to the floor of the Senate. I will be very frank and clear-eyed. Republicans are against it. Regrettably, it is a partisan issue. It shouldn't be. There's nothing red or blue about ethical standards for the highest court in the land. But right now, that highest court has the lowest standards of ethics. And I fear that it may not get the 60 votes that it needs when it comes to a vote in the Senate, but it should come to a vote. We should hold accountable everybody in the United States Senate.
Get them on record.
Get them on record.
Another thing that I just have so much admiration for your fight in this, and also it is something that should not be a partisan issue. Recently, you and Republican Senator Marsha Blackburn introduced the Kids Online Safety Act, which is so important for so many reasons. First of all, I have two kids who are just on that verge. They're 8 and 11. And they're just potentially, they're straddling that line of being ready for social media in their mind, not in my mind, and still being innocent to the fact that social media is a dangerous place.
Last week, we spoke with Facebook whistleblower Frances Haugen about the increasingly dangerous impact social media is having on children and teenagers' mental health. Last year, Haugen released internal Facebook documents that suggested the company was prioritizing profits over the safety of its users.
Tell us what inspired you to introduce this really critical bill.
I am so grateful to you for your interest and your dedication to this topic. And not just because you have two children, I have four, but also because it is so essential to the mental health of all of our children and indeed our society. We're in the midst of a mental health crisis. And what really caught my interest and my passion is the haunting, harrowing stories from young people, as well as from parents, about the toxic content that is driven at them, about bullying, about eating disorders, about suicide, about drug abuse, so destructive, exploiting their anxieties and their anger. The social media, big tech companies have a business model, which is to sadden or anger or depress young people so as to make them more likely to stay on the sites. It's addictive. It's a purposely attractive menace. And the more eyeballs, the more dollars they make, because it's the key to advertisers. So we had a whistleblower after a number of hearings who testified about this business model. She presented documents that showed big tech knows the harm that it's causing. We have written legislation that is bipartisan. It now has 44 co-sponsors. That's almost half the Senate, evenly divided, Republicans, Democrats. And just a couple of weeks ago, the Senate Commerce Committee unanimously approved it for the floor of the Senate and a vote. So it's a big deal. And what it would do essentially is give parents and kids the tools they need to disconnect from these black box algorithms that drive the toxic content at kids. It would also hold the big tech companies accountable when they know that they're causing these harms or should have reason to know. And then it would provide for transparency so that the algorithms would be, in effect, disclosed. They would be brought out of the shadows. Sunlight is the best disinfectant. Right now, nobody knows how these algorithms work, and it would disclose, in fact, how they do work.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Yeah, I remember back in the 90s when tobacco companies were held to account for making their product especially addictive to children. And we've seen that again more recently with flavored vape cartridges. Vaping is a huge issue. Do you see parallels between the tobacco industry's behavior and the behavior of social media companies?
Very, very clearly, yes. And I know something about the tobacco lawsuits because I led them. When I was attorney general, we sued big tobacco. And by the way, they had, just as the big tech companies have, lots of money to oppose us, lots of lobbyists and lawyers. But we won in court. And we won because they were marketing to children, which is parallel to what big tech is doing here. They not only marketed to children, but they knew that their product was addictive. And you may not think that what big tech markets or drives at children is addictive in the same way. It isn't nicotine, it isn't a chemical, but it is psychologically addictive. And the other parallel is they're making tons of money. It is a cash cow for them because advertisers want kids on these sites. They want information about the kids, which is generated when kids go to the site. And the other final parallel is that both big tech and big tobacco have engaged in a cover-up, in effect, trying to conceal what they were doing. And I think we will be as successful against big tech as we were against big tobacco.
The attorney generals have now before them a tobacco settlement proposal that would provide the states with $206 billion through the year 2025, the largest financial recovery in the history of the world. And we would require the most sweeping changes in business practices ever imposed on an industry. It will change the way we see tobacco.
Big tobacco eventually lost in a settlement that we were able to achieve. Big tech is not being sued right now by the Congress or state attorneys general in the same way. But I believe that the country is ready to have the Kids Online Safety Act give parents tools that they can use to protect their children, disconnect from the algorithm, impose a responsibility, a duty of care on big tech so that law enforcement and people who are harmed can take action.
And it is very comparable because nicotine rises dopamine levels and so does social media. The same areas in the brain light up when anyone is on social media as they do with a drug, anything that would raise dopamine levels. So it is biological. It is neurological. The Kids Online Safety Act has seen some pushback from free speech advocates and other activist groups saying that it'll limit free speech and restrict access to critical information. I know you and Senator Blackburn introduced a revised version of this bill to try to address those concerns. And I would just love to give you the opportunity to just address some of that pushback.
That's a really important point, Alyssa. I'm so glad you raised it because we have clarified certain features of the bill to address those concerns. For example, the LGBTQ community raised some very valid questions. We have, I think, successfully met those concerns, and their opposition has been dissipated. So I don't want to speak for them, but I'm very gratified that they have relooked at the book, at the bill, and now have, in effect, withdrawn any the kinds of oppositions that they had. Now, there's some groups that may be against it because they have doctrinaire positions on free speech. Anything goes. Okay, if big tech has a right to drive this toxic content at kids about eating disorders and bullying and drug abuse and suicide, if that's an exercise of the First Amendment, well, they have a right to take that position. But we're trying to protect kids. And the excesses in First Amendment position shouldn't prevent us from achieving this legislation, which I think represents a real consensus. And to give you some examples, we've narrowed the duty of care so that LGBTQ young people who want to go on the internet will have a means to do so. We haven't imposed a strict age cutoff, which would isolate kids. We want to put the burden on big tech, not on the kids, not on the parents. And that's been a lesson for us in some of the feedback we've received, valuable feedback from groups and individuals who have expressed concerns. You know, I think we have reached a real consensus here that's very constructive.
And of course, social media is not the only place kids right now are facing unprecedented threats. Florida, for example, just adopted videos from an extremist right-wing propaganda group for use in the classrooms, which it's unfathomable to me. And among these things that the videos show, they teach kids that slavery is excusable and that girls should smile more to enhance their femininity. What is the role of the federal government in protecting kids in Florida and around the country from this dangerous grooming, if you will?
I think it's really regrettable that kids are used as pawns in this ideological warfare, and particularly since young people are impressionable. We tend to forget, you're very much aware of it, with an 11-year-old and an 8-year-old, that kids are receiving knowledge and impressions every day with lasting effect. Their brains aren't fully developed, which is why social media can be so destructive. They don't have the same powers of judgment, let's face it. And so I think the federal government has an obligation to protect kids against this kind of real extremism. And I also think that the violent extremism that we're seeing across the country is a real threat to our internal security. In fact, I'm on the Judiciary Committee as well as the Armed Services Committee. What we are told by the intelligence community is the biggest threat to our internal security these days, it's not the bomber who's going to drive a plane into a skyscraper. It is the domestic terrorists, the white supremacists who will use violence internally in this country.
Do not, for the love of God, tell kids that slavery was beneficial, because I can guarantee you it most certainly was not. Thank you.
Education and civil rights advocates are slamming new Black history teaching standards in Florida. Under the new rules, middle school teachers must now include lessons, quote, how slaves developed skills, which in some instances could be applied for their personal benefit.
It's inaccurate. It's ahistorical. Critics are calling this a big step backwards and saying it's a disservice to Florida students because they're not going to learn the full truth and the full accurate truth of American history.
That's probably the most pressing, persistent, and lethal threat to our internal security.
And obviously, gun violence is soaring in this country. Now, more than 46,000 Americans die every year from gunshot wounds. More than 100,000 are shot but survive. It has been more than a decade since the Sandy Hook school shooting in your state, and guns are now the number one killer of kids and teens. I was at a welcoming meeting for my son's middle school last night, and they were talking about security and how the changes that they're making this year will make school more safe, and they're going to be adding armed security. And it's just, it feels like instead of treating the cancer, we are just allowing it to metastasize in every aspect of our livelihoods and our lives. Why is it so hard to do something about this? It can't just be the gun lobbyists, is it?
A lot of it is the gun lobby, which is fueled by the gun manufacturers, but it is also the right-wing extremists that have such strong sway right now in the Republican Party. And I know we're not going to be partisan, at least I will try to avoid being partisan, but what we see is a polarization in the politics of this country. Let's be just very blunt about it. People have gone to their corners. And right now, minority of what used to be the Republican Party, which are the extreme right wing, along with the gun lobby, are able to shape the outcomes, especially in the Senate, where we need 60 votes to accomplish anything. I first became involved in the gun violence issue back in the early 1990s, when I helped pass in our state law in Connecticut, a ban on assault weapons. I defended it in court as attorney general. The arguments that are made now were defeated then. I introduced just a few days ago, reintroduced a ban on ghost guns. New technology has enabled frames and receivers, parts of guns, to be sold without serial numbers, unserialized and untraceable. We had at the press conference announcing it, the chief of police of Hartford, who says this is one of the most pressing emerging threats to law enforcement. Our cops face these ghost guns and they can't solve crimes because the guns cannot be traced. There's an example, along with safe storage and improving our background check system, of the kind of common sense steps that we can and should take, just as we did with the bipartisan Safer Communities Act last year. We can make progress if we just advocate and continue to mobilize common sense Americans. And the overwhelming majority of Americans want these measures. 90% of people want better background check system. And as you said, we have a whole generation growing up with drills in school that make them anxious, that are traumatic after a while, because they come to school fearful that they're going to see the mass shootings.
They're called the lockdown generation. Millions of America's children taught to prepare for scenes like this in Uvalde.
They've been doing it since preschool.
Stacy Feely posted this on Facebook when Chandler was only 3 years old.
She said she was practicing for a lockdown drill and what you would do if you were stuck in the bathroom. My heart sank.
And you felt something about your daughter's sense of innocence at that time.
I really thought that, okay, this is a very fast way of growing up.
Some schools began holding lockdown drills in the wake of Columbine 23 years ago. Today, more than 95% of public schools conduct them.
They watched on TV and the news, and they may have seen them in real life, because it isn't just the mass shootings. It is also the drive-by shooting, one by one, that happen in some of our communities. It's the suicides. 50% of all gun deaths are suicide. And we can prevent them by simply separating people from guns, separating them from guns when they say they're going to kill someone or kill themselves.
Well, we've now reached a point where there are many more guns than people in this country. Do you think that we've hit a point of no return? Do you think that we can fix this?
I think we have the power and the obligation, and we will do it as long as we keep fighting and avoid losing hope. And I really want to thank you for raising this issue, because we can't surrender. We're not going away. We're not giving up. I'm going to continue working and fighting for gun violence prevention. And I'll tell you what we have seen that's very different from when I first started on this issue. We now have a movement. It's grassroots group. Moms demand action. Every town. You can go down March for Our Lives, Connecticut Against Gun Violence, Sandy Hook Promise, Newtown Action Alliance. We now have a grassroots movement, which is more powerful than the gun lobby. And that's what will turn it around.
I want to switch topics. I told you I have a lot to talk to you about. So if it feels like I'm jumping with no real good segue, it's because I am, because I want to just get to as much as I possibly can with you. We're talking on Zoom right now. There was a terms of service hysteria a few days ago where it said, Zoom said that they were going to potentially use the data and our face images for AI. So I want to switch topics to artificial intelligence. You and Josh Hawley serve on the Senate Judiciary Committee on Privacy, Technology, and the Law, and recently held a hearing into AI. First of all, why did you have that hearing?
I'm the chairman of that subcommittee on privacy and tech. And again, just like I work with Marsha Blackburn, she's a Republican from Tennessee. We probably vote together on maybe 3% of the issue. Josh Hawley and Blumenthal, again, an unlikely pair. But I really try to find common objectives and common ground wherever I can, because nothing gets done in Congress unless it's bipartisan. And here we have come together because we see a threat. We see great promise. AI, artificial intelligence, been around for 10 years. What we're seeing now is a new form of it, generative artificial intelligence. It's more creative. Think of it that way. It's still machine learning right now, but it can, for example, screen x-rays of your lung to see whether you have cancer more accurately than many pulmonologists could do. It can do research that could provide some cures to cancer. It can produce all kinds of scientific disruption, but it also has some real downsides. The deep fakes, images that are concocted and put together, the impersonations that it can do, taking words or speeches and then putting them together. I opened one of the hearings by having my voice do an introduction to the hearing. I said, now for an introduction. And then we played my voice. Wasn't actually my voice. It was taken from my speeches on the floor. And what it was saying was not something I ever wrote or composed. It was ChatGPT, and it sounded exactly like me.
Too often, we have seen what happens when technology outpaces regulation. The unbridled exploitation of personal data, the proliferation of disinformation, and the deepening of societal inequalities. We have seen how algorithmic biases can perpetuate discrimination and prejudice, and how the lack of transparency can undermine public trust. This is not the future we want. If you were listening from home, you might have thought that voice was mine and the words from me, but in fact, that voice was not mine. The words were not mine, and the audio was an AI voice cloning software trained on my floor speeches. The remarks were written by ChatGPT.
My kids couldn't believe that it wasn't me. It sounded like it was. And so that impersonation, the deep fakes, the scams that can come from somebody impersonating your child, and it's not somebody, it's actually their voice taken from someplace else, and then, in effect, artificially put together. So there are some really grave dangers here as well as promise.
Well, in my industry, we have two unions on strike right now, the WGA and SAG-AFTRA, because giant corporations are trying to claim, now listen to this, ownership of actors' likenesses, not just the way they look, but the things they are portrayed doing and saying for eternity without additional pay or consent over what they are portrayed doing, right? They are trying to replace writers with computers. And I think that this is true all across all industries. AI is a threat to jobs and our economy. What do you think needs to be done so that art and work are not destroyed by these machines?
Another great question, Alyssa. The copyright laws, the protections for creative production, the kinds of safeguards for the inventions by artists, actors, writers. We need to revise these laws because, as you say, artificial intelligence can take those creations, modify them, and in effect, reproduce them in ways that the artists get no credit and no financial remuneration. The AI-powered synthetic audio system can equip malicious actors to clone voices. They can put together images that are of actors without their permission and without their compensation. So we need to revise our laws to offer them greater protection. Senator Hawley and I will be soon unveiling a framework for legislation. And what we're going to be proposing, I think, is a new entity, an oversight body, modeled on the Food and Drug Administration, which reviews new drugs to make sure they're safe and effective before they can be released to the public. Here we have the same kind of innovation, which poses dangers as well as potential benefits, that should be reviewed before it's unleashed. And I think we will come up with some combination of framework that includes the safeguards against atomic weapons and the support for research that's in NASA, but also the oversight of an agency like the Food and Drug Administration.
In June, a poll was released saying that nearly half of the CEOs believed that AI could destroy humanity itself in the next decade. Do we need a new Geneva Convention or some other kind of international framework that limits the military or other combat development of AI? Like, how do we fix that part?
The nightmare, Alyssa, is that AI is put in charge of atomic weapons, and that somehow it is programmed to send those bombs on a signal without any potential for reversing it, or maybe react on its own in some way. This science fiction fantasy is no longer fantasy, and it's no longer fiction. There is an existential threat here. And that's why the scientists, some of the leading researchers, wrote to the president and others, urging that there be some action to protect people against the potential dangers of generative AI. And it's not just what we're seeing right now. It's what we'll see in the future.
Jeffrey Hinton, the sometimes called godfather of artificial intelligence, is trying to explain its risks to the world.
This is just something somebody sent me from Twitter.
Which means explaining something very real that can sound entirely made up.
I'm lost. I don't know.
He's eager for good communication of the urgency, and look who might be offering it. Snoop Dogg.
It's blowing my mind because I watched movies on this as a kid. And I heard the old dude that created AI talking about, this is not safe because the AI's got their own minds and these motherfuckers gonna start doing their own shit. I'm like, is we in a fucking movie right now or what? The fuck, man? Do y'all know?
That's what people are saying. He's like, are we in trouble?
He gets it. He's smart.
Right now we have ChatGPT-4, but we're going to have 5. We'll have 6, 7, 8. And we'll have Bard and other models from Microsoft, from Google, from many of the others. And as you say, there's an international aspect of it because China is developing its own AI. So I think ultimately we need an international framework.
I mean, I have to tell you, as an outsider looking in on what you do, it always feels like bipartisanship is impossible right now to achieve in Congress. And yet we've just had this conversation now for 36 minutes. And two of the things that we discussed today, you did with Republican colleagues. And it's amazing. And I wish that we focused more on the collaboration instead of the conflict. Can you just give us an accurate picture of what it's like working across the aisle today? Is it harder than when you first started?
It is harder. It is certainly much harder than when I first worked in the Senate, which was many years ago. I was an aide, very young aide, to Senator Abraham Ribicoff of Connecticut. And there was much more bipartisan collaboration. It is much more difficult now because we've become so polarized. And I'm hoping that maybe after this next election, the fever will be dissipated, the fever of partisanship, and we'll be able to work together more easily. But I come to work every day, literally, hoping that I can find a Republican part for what I'm doing, or that I can enhance the partnership that I have already with Marsha Blackburn or Josh Hawley, or on sports, for example, Jerry Moran of Kansas, Republican, and I and Cory Booker have submitted a draft for legislation that would protect college athletes' rights, not just their rights to name, image, and likeness, but also to medical treatment and scholarships. If they are recruited and they're given scholarships and they're injured, they should not be deprived of that scholarship. They should continue to receive medical treatment through a trust fund. And again, another example, I will tell you where I have not been able to find bipartisan agreement, and that is on reproductive rights.
I was just going to say women's rights.
Women's rights, women's health care. And I know you've been very active, and I want to thank you for your leadership on this issue. And my hope is that we will eventually have bipartisan agreement that women's reproductive rights are women's health care. And now with contraceptive pill being available over the counter, I've just renewed my call for insurance coverage of non-prescription contraceptive pills. They are now going to be available at pharmacies, but they need to have it affordable. So I'm hoping that maybe we can get some bipartisan cooperation.
You know, it would really help with that, right? The Equal Rights Amendment.
All for it. Absolutely.
Let's go. Let's put women in the Constitution. Finally, my last question is, what gives you hope?
My hope is for my children and your children to continue to have the United States of America as you and I know it now, as we believe in it, with all the freedoms that are so unique in the world, with the rights that we cherish. And we see in Ukraine, for example, I've been a very strong supporter of Ukraine, the fight against totalitarianism, barbarism, murder, the invasion by Putin, who will keep going if we don't stop him in Ukraine. I hope we will stop him and preserve the rights and independence for our country without greater sacrifice from our young people. But most important, that we come together in a bipartisan way, committed to this great experiment in democracy, and that we do it in a way that is peaceful.
Senator Blumenthal, you give me hope. Thank you so much for being a part of the podcast.
Thank you, Alyssa. Really enjoyed it.
Professor Marcus, we are here today because we do face that perfect storm. Some of us might characterize it more like a bomb in a China shop, not a bull. And as Senator Hawley indicated, there are precedents here, not only the atomic warfare era, but also the Genome Project, the research on genetics, where there was international cooperation as a result. And we want to avoid those past mistakes, as I indicated in my opening statement, that were committed on social media. That is precisely the reason we are here today.
The constant threats to children in America were unimaginable even a generation ago. From constant gun violence in schools and in public to the pressures of social media to the mental health challenges, kids are being forced to face things faster than we can address them as a culture. That's why it is so important that our elected officials move quickly and put partisan politics aside to protect them. Keeping kids safe from mass shooting shouldn't be a Republican or Democratic issue. Protecting their mental health shouldn't be liberal or conservative. And shaping a future that allows them to find meaningful and fulfilling work instead of being replaced by AI should be a bedrock principle of all government officials. These should all be easy to get behind. We should all be able to agree that addressing these problems now and in the future is in the best interest of America and her children. And we need more people like Senator Blumenthal in office to get it done.
Sorry Not Sorry is executive produced by Alyssa Milano. That's me. Our producer is Ben Jackson, audio editing and engineering by Maciej Lewandowski, and music by Josh Cook, Alicia Eagle, and Milo Bugliari. Don't forget to rate, review, and spread the word. Sorry, not sorry.